Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Pete Anderson. Today I'll be reading from the Hartford Business Journal. The first story we're going to look at today is titled East Hartford Company Develops Virtual Reality Training for EMTs and Paramedics. Chris DeRosa is an emergency medical technician instructor who has been there and done that. In fact, while serving as a firefighter in South Carolina, he and his crew once assisted in three different emergency births in a span of 6 days. More recently, DeRosa, now the department head for Criminal Justice and Protective Services at Bullard Havens Technical High School in Bridgeport, has served as a consultant for East Hartford-based VRSim. The company has developed virtual reality training for emergency medical services personnel, EMTs, and paramedics. The program, which is being released on March 8th, was recently demonstrated during an event at the University of St. Joseph in West Hartford. DeRosa said VRSim's new technology will broaden access to and improve EMT training. I think it's going to give students a better understanding of the skills that they need in order to finish the state and national level certification tests, he said. Matthew Wallace, president and CEO of VRSim, said his company developed the virtual reality EMT training system as a way to make a dent in the shortage of EMTs and paramedics. The goal is a better training modality, better training faster, he said. VRSim was founded in the early 2000s by creating a VR simulator that could train welders. That was followed by a VR system to train workers painting with industrial coatings like those used on submarines. The company last year expanded into VR training for certified nursing assistants. VRSim currently employs 18 people and expects to generate $5 million in revenue this year, Wallace said. After learning about a statewide shortage of firefighters, EMTs, and paramedics, which prompted Governor Ned Lamont to establish a task force to address the issue last year, VRSim decided to develop its new training system for emergency medical personnel to help speed training. Wallace said he was approached by former East Hartford Mayor Mike Walsh, who told him the town's emergency service units were trying to attract young adults who can be trained in basic emergency services skills. 8 months later, VRSim created the training program, Wallace said. VR training systems have an advantage with younger adults who have grown up using computers and playing video games, Wallace said. VRSim allows training for not only the more common scenarios like treating a patient in cardiac arrest, but rare situations that would be difficult to set up in real life, like chemical spills or emergency births. By using this, we can also give them exposure to events that are less common but have high value, Wallace said. Something like a live childbirth where they don't have time to get to the hospital. While emergency births are generally considered rare, it's something DeRosa knows a lot about. While serving in the Army in South Carolina, he was released from active duty and trained to serve as a firefighter in Richland County. I did a week of training, and on the last Friday they put you out on the street, he said. That Friday afternoon, the crew I was with, we delivered a baby. The following Monday, he said, he and his crew handled another emergency birth, but they weren't done. That Wednesday, we had another, he said. DeRosa, who has tried VRSim's EMT virtual reality training system, said it's very realistic. The birthing one that they have is an excellent thing, he said. It's a high-risk, low-frequency type call, so it's one of those skills you don't get to do often, and the portion of the program where you do the skill is right on what's going to happen in the real world. Wallace said VRSim has contracts with experts like DeRosa to review programs and ensure the accuracy that they must meet the training requirements. The next story from the Hartford Business Journal is titled Trade Industries Push for Apprenticeship Hiring Ratio Reform. A Republican legislator who also runs a small electrical company wants to reduce the state's apprenticeship hiring ratio, which supporters say would help bolster Connecticut's trade industry workforce. However, opponents believe the change could lead to a deterioration of apprenticeship programs. State Representative Tim Ackert, a Republican from Coventry, and a plethora of construction industry employers and contractors recently met at the Legislative Office Building in Hartford to advocate for a change to the state's apprenticeship hiring ratio requirements for certain industries. The State Department of Consumer Protection imposes a so-called hiring ratio on contracting companies in electrical, plumbing, and metalworking trades. The rule is a bit technical, but it essentially requires contractors to have a certain number of licensed journeymen on staff for each apprentice they hire. The rule allows contractors to hire up to 3 apprentices at a 1-to-1 ratio. That means a company must have 3 licensed journeymen on staff if it wants 3 apprentices. It would need 2 journeymen for 2 apprentices. After the first 3 apprentice hires, employers must abide by a 1-to-3 ratio. That means for each new apprentice, the company must have 3 additional journeymen. So a company with 12 licensed journeymen can only have 6 apprentices on staff. Ackert, a licensed electrical contractor who owns Coventry-based Ackert Electric, LLC, said he wants the 1-to-3 ratio reduced to 1-to-1, similar to a proposal he brought up several years ago. Advocates for the change argue that the current ratio restricts licensed contractors from bringing on new hires to work in the trades, stifling workforce development at a time when Connecticut has 94,000 job openings. The trades in particular have been hit hard by labor shortages. There are people wanting to get into the trades who have already got their training started, and we can't hire them because we have a ratio of 3 licensed people to train 1 apprentice in hiring, Ackert said in a recent interview. Proponents of the 1-to-3 ratio, including some labor unions, say it ensures less experienced and unlicensed workers are properly supervised. They also argue it prevents contractors from hiring a large number of apprentices who can serve as cheaper labor compared to more experienced workers, some of whom belong to unions. Changing the ratio, they argue, would have an adverse effect on the integrity of Connecticut's apprenticeship base as a whole. Strong licensing standards don't just benefit union contractors and union workers. They benefit non-union employers. They benefit non-union workers. They benefit the whole industry, said Kimberly Glassman, director of the Foundation for Fair Contracting of Connecticut, a private nonprofit that promotes and protects prevailing wage standards on federal, state, and municipal works projects. Ackert, who sits on the Labor and Public Employees, Energy and Technology, and General Law Committees, said reducing the ratio could lead to 500 new jobs in the state across all impacted trades. He said he's been looking for a committee to raise the ratio reform bill for debate this session. At a press conference in February, Independent Electrical Contractors of New England Executive Director Allie French spoke in favor of the change. We are behind the ball on replenishing the skilled labor workforce in Connecticut, French said. Right now, roughly 20% of our apprentices are not working in an industry that desperately needs jobs filled. It's time to make this simple change to help our employees create jobs and ultimately strengthen our economy. But Glassman of the Foundation for Fair Contracting said changing the ratio isn't necessary. She said contractors can already ask the State Department of Labor for ratio relief or a waiver that allows companies to continue to hire on a 1-to-1 ratio even after they brought on 3 apprentices. There have been talks about streamlining the waiver process to make it easier for businesses to go through, Glassman said, but outright eliminating the ratio requirement would be going overboard. It feels like a bit of a red herring at this point when you can easily go and get more apprentices if you need to, but you have to prove to the state that you have the need and that you have to hire more apprentices, Glassman said. Glassman noted that apprentices get paid less than their journeyman peers, and the pay discrepancy combined with a one-to-one ratio could result in employers hiring apprentices and then laying them off before they achieve higher-paying journeyman status. If we're going to talk about changing the ratio, what we're talking about is allowing more contractors to hire a cheaper labor pool, Glassman said. Our concern is not about giving people more opportunity to enter an apprenticeship program. It's about employers exploiting the apprenticeship program to keep them paying substandard wages. Despite the waiver option, contractors say the red tape is stifling. Tim Schneider, CEO of solar energy company Earthlight Technologies, said his firm has 25 electricians and 8 apprentices. By amending the law, we could employ another 12 apprentices who are currently unable to make a positive career transition toward a better salary to support their families, Schneider said. We can't continue to ask for waivers to hire new apprentices, many of which rarely succeed. We need to change the law now and stand with our youth. State Senator Julie Kushner, a Democrat from Danbury, co-chair of the Labor and Public Employees Committee, noted the legislature last year approved a new law that requires companies to disclose apprenticeship-related data that will help shed more light on the need to change the ratio. The law requires companies to disclose the number of apprentices they have on staff, how many have gone on to complete their full licensing, and the number of journeymen on staff. Some of these trades are very dangerous trades, and workers can get hurt if they don't have the proper supervision, and I know that is something that concerns us greatly, Kushner said. The next story we're going to look at from the Hartford Business Journal is titled Quality versus Quantity. This is subtitled Hospitals and Insurers Eye Value-Based Care Deals to Cut Costs and Improve Patient Outcomes. Trinity Health of New England in January announced a new contract agreement with Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield that prominently mentioned an increasingly common payment model for modern health care. The organizations said they will collaborate on value-based care models with the intent to both improve health outcomes and better control costs for Trinity Health patients who are covered by Anthem health plans. Value-based care has been a much-talked-about goal for the healthcare industry, and efforts to accept it could have a significant impact on patients, as well as employers that underwrite health insurance, typically at a significant and increasing cost for their workers. At its roots, value-based care aims to move away from transitional fee-for-service model and instead pay providers, including physicians and hospitals, based on the health outcomes of their patients and quality of care. It represents a major potential shift in the industry's economics and has led to increasingly tough contract negotiations between insurers and providers, particularly hospitals, as both sides remain skittish on how to balance the financial risk. Jeffrey Hogan, president of Upside Health Advisors in Farmington, is a healthcare consultant and promoter of value-based healthcare, which he said focuses on the quality of care patients receive. That's in contrast to the fee-for-service system, which some might call a sick system, Hogan said, that is based on getting paid for treating as many patients as possible. Under that system, there is little to no coordination of care. Patients can go wherever they want, whenever they want. It's a fragmented care, he said. It's not clinically integrated and coordinated. You may be going to 5 different doctors, and 4 of them don't know that you're going to a different practitioner. Because of that, he added, it's difficult to control costs. Proof of those inefficiencies is reflected in the increased costs employers and the nation face on an annual basis for healthcare services. U.S. healthcare spending grew 4.1% in 2022, reaching a $4.5 trillion, which represented 17.3% of the nation's gross domestic product, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. On the other hand, value-based healthcare uses primary care physicians as the tip of the spear to manage each patient's care, Hogan said. Several advanced primary care organizations have moved into the state in recent years, seeing opportunities to improve upon Connecticut's fragmented healthcare system that leads to huge variation in cost and quality between and among providers, Hogan said. New entrants have included Walgreens-backed VillageMD, which last year acquired Starling Physicians, a 30-location medical group in central Connecticut, and Virginia-based Privia Health, which last year announced a partnership with New Haven-based Community Medical Group to launch Privia Quality Network of Connecticut, which consists of 1,100 multi-specialty providers, including 430 primary care providers. These primary care organizations are basically quarterbacks coordinating the total cost of care, and that includes coordinating care with specialist and ambulatory surgical centers, any of the things a patient might be involved with, Hogan said. The intent is to optimize access to appropriate care and to create appropriate outcomes that are predictable, he added. Predictability is one reason for the growing popularity of the value-based care model, especially for employers that provide health insurance plans for their workers. According to Hogan, finding affordable, predictable health care took on a new meaning for employers in 2021 when Congress approved the Consolidated Appropriations Act. The act, in part, imposed huge new requirements on any employer that sponsors a health plan, he said. Under the new federal rules, employers have a fiduciary responsibility to provide health care similar to the one imposed on companies providing retirement plans. Employers that buy or self-fund employee health plans must evaluate the cost of those services in the contract for the appropriateness to the needs of the people in your group, Hogan said. The new rules caused a big, big change in the marketplace, he said. You must know what the cost is. You must know what you should be paying and what you could be paying. The kind of predictability can be especially difficult in a fee-for-service system, whereas the value-based care contract allows employers to contract with a healthcare system to create predictability around the cost and the quality of care, Hogan said. Controlling the cost of care isn't easy in Connecticut. Last year, Governor Ned Lamont released the state's first-ever health care spending benchmark report, which concluded that health care costs in the state increased by 6% between 2020 and 2021. That topped Connecticut's 3.4% growth benchmark. Hogan said part of the reason for high health care costs in Connecticut is the lack of investment in primary care. He referred to data from the Primary Care Collaborative, a not-for-profit organization that promotes patient-centered primary care. The Collaborative published a study several years ago looking at primary care investment in all 50 states and ranked Connecticut last in the nation. It also concluded that increased primary care spending leads to fewer emergency department visits and total hospitalizations, which are major cost drivers. Part of the problem in Connecticut, Hogan said, is that many patients prefer to see specialists first before a primary care doctor, which leads to fragmented care and higher costs. Your knee hurts, so you go to an orthopedic surgeon. Your heart's palpitating, so you go to a cardiologist, Hogan said. Trinity Health of New England, which operates several Connecticut hospitals, including St. Francis in Hartford and Johnson Memorial in Stafford, and Anthem declined to share terms of their new contract. But they did describe their efforts to adopt value-based care models. Emily Brower, Senior Vice President for Clinical Integration and Physician Services at Trinity Health of New England, said the value-based care model relies on bringing services closer to patients to improve access. Trinity Health has done that, Brower said, by opening new ambulatory care centers in the state and investing in telemedicine. Value-based care also puts more emphasis on the prevention and management of chronic health conditions, which can be major drivers of emergency room visits and hospital stays, she said. If we reduce the need for higher cost emergent care, we actually return the savings to our providers, Brower said, in describing how a value-based care model works. If we're able to reduce the need for care or deliver that care in a less costly setting, then some of that savings returns to us. It's shared between us and the payer. Wendy Poisonelli, Anthem's Regional Vice President of Healthcare Networks in Connecticut, said hospitals and health systems have grown more open to value-based care models since the COVID-19 pandemic. I think it's a high level. It's really rewarding hospitals for keeping people healthier versus paying for appointment after appointment, Poisonelli said. Anthem's value-based care program is called Enhanced Personal Health Care, or EPHC. According to Poisonelli, the EPHC program has contracts in Connecticut with 14 accountable care organizations that represent 3,500 primary care physicians. Combined, those physicians treat more than 400,000 patients, she said. She also stressed the important role primary care physicians play in value-based care programs. Our value-based care models really look to reward doctors and other providers for care coordination, she said. Primary care is one of the best places to start because we really see the benefits of value-based care arrangements. Turning now to our next story from the Hartford Business Journal. This is titled Joint Venture. The story is subtitled Johnson Memorial Hospital eyes $17.8 million Enfield Surgical Center to be partially owned by physicians. After completing a $6 million renovation and reopening its cancer center in Enfield last summer, Johnson Memorial Hospital has proposed a more than $17 million upgrade to its nearby surgery center that would include making it an outpatient facility partially owned by physicians. The proposal is part of a larger $40 million investment in Johnson Memorial's Enfield campus, and it reflects elements of a value-based care model that aims to lower costs and improve patient outcomes, officials said. According to a project application filed with the State Office of Health Strategy, which needs to approve the plans, Johnson Memorial wants to convert its existing Enfield surgical facility operations from a hospital-based outpatient department to a freestanding outpatient surgical facility located on the second floor of a $17.8 million, 43,200-square-foot medical office building already under construction on the Hazard Avenue campus. In addition, Johnson Memorial, which is owned by Trinity Health of New England, would transfer ownership of the surgical center to a new joint venture called the Enfield Surgery Center. Trinity Health of New England would hold a 51% stake, while physicians would own the remaining 49%. Trinity Health identified Greater Enfield as a key market in which to expand and to modernize its ambulatory services, according to the project application, known as a Certificate of Need. Based on that, the organization undertook a refresh of the Enfield campus, including renovating its Karen Davis Cancer Center and constructing a new surgical center. Many health systems in Connecticut and nationwide have been shifting non-emergency care out of hospitals to lower-cost urgent care or outpatient surgery centers. The trend has led hospital operators like Trinity Health, Hartford Healthcare, and Yale New Haven Health to open new or acquire stakes in existing surgery centers. Other companies, like insurers and private equity firms, have also been investing in freestanding outpatient surgical centers, which are seen as future growth engines. Johnson Memorial, which has its main campus in Stafford, projects its modernized Enfield Surgery Center will perform over 5,000 procedures during its first year of operation and more than 6,000 by its third full year. In fiscal year 2022, the hospital reported $65.8 million in operating revenue and an operating loss of $13.3 million, according to the Office of Health Strategy. Johnson Memorial's new building, called Ambulatory Care Center, is set to be completed in May and go live this summer. The existing Enfield Surgical Center, which is located on the same campus, has four licensed operating rooms, but is outdated and outliving its useful lifespan, the hospital said. The new facility will have four state-of-the-art operating rooms and two recovery rooms, although only three operating rooms would function at the start, with the fourth coming online as demand increases, the hospital said. Johnson Memorial has operated an ambulatory surgical center in Enfield for several decades, said hospital president Dr. Robert Roos in an interview with the Hartford Business Journal. The modernized facility, he said, will expand and enhance the care the hospital can provide and complement industry trends of shifting less serious, lower-risk inpatient surgical cases to outpatient facilities and forming joint ventures between physicians and hospitals. Partial ownership will incentivize participating physicians to provide low-cost, high-quality care to patients, thus resulting in a value-driven operation, the hospital said. In surgical centers where surgeons and hospitals are part owners, Roos added, you can deliver care in a way that's going to be the highest standard, but also in a way that is most efficient utilization of resources, which can keep the cost down for the patients and the overall community. Participation in the joint venture does not require physicians or surgeons to be part of practices owned by Trinity Health of New England, Roos said. We are in the process of engaging private and employed surgeons and physicians from the community, he said. As we create the organization that will be managing the center, we will have more information as it develops. Jeffrey Hogan, president of Farmington-based Upside Health Advisors and a healthcare consultant, said converting a surgical center to an outpatient facility partially owned by physicians makes sense as a way to reduce the cost of care. There are only a certain number of specialists who do things, and they're attached to ownership, Hogan said. They want skin in the game. He said physicians and surgeons also benefit because they get predictable lower costs for high-volume services. The decision, he added, reflects the fact that hospital systems now realize that a lot of treatment is going out of the hospitals because hospital prices have been consistently rising by double digits. In order to stay competitive and maintain some of that revenue, hospitals have to offer an attractive business case to attract surgeons, which includes the ownership stake in surgical centers, Hogan said. Johnson Memorial's project application also notes that converting from a hospital-owned and operated facility to a joint venture would eliminate hospital facility fees, further reducing care costs. Health systems charge facility fees for outpatient services provided in a hospital-based setting in order to cover operational expenses. Well, that's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the Hartford Business Journal. I'm Pete Anderson. So long until next time.